Hello and welcome to the Many Rules of Film Club. This is Jeff Yance, the program director at the Loft Cinema, and I'd like to introduce, as always, occasional filmmaker Heather Lattice.
Hi, Jeff.
And multimedia artist Rusty Boulay-Stevenson.
Hello there.
Hello. So Heather and Rusty, I think probably safe to say that we are all science fiction fans.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yes. And proud of it.
Yes.
Heck yeah.
Okay, good. So this week on the Many Rules of Film Club, we're going to be looking at what I think is considered the golden age of science fiction filmmaking, which is the 1950s. Really fun stuff in that decade. You could really get lost in a wormhole watching 50s sci-fi movies.
Yeah, I have,
I
in fact.
Yes. Yes. So I think, you know, there are probably three. I was kind of thinking about this before we started today. There are three maybe defining elements of 50s sci-fi movies: big bugs, flying saucers, Cold War paranoia.
Yes.
Which encompasses the atomic bomb and all of that good stuff, communism. And so with that in mind, we're going to look at some of the classics and maybe some of the not so classics.
That's right.
Of the 50s sci-fi genre, and kind of maybe look at how it kind of fits into those three elements of the genre. So Heather, maybe let's talk about the film that we were talking about with you earlier. Probably one of the first, quote unquote, I guess, legitimate big studio science fiction films to come out of Hollywood, which was Forbidden Planet.
Yes, 1956. And the reason why I picked this one, because I would have went along the lines of a more cheesy, campy 50s sci-fi, but it is so beautiful.
Beautiful.
This film is so ridiculously beautiful. The art direction, the editing, the actors, it's shot in CinemaScope, which is one of my favorites as well.
Yes.
So Forbidden Planet, 1956, directed by Fred M. Wilcox. Not a director I remembered, but
he directed the Lassie movies.
Oh, really? Wow.
Forbidden Planet and Lassie Come Home.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Stars Walter Pidgeon and Francis Leslie Nielsen in his very young, dapper, handsome years, which I didn't know he had.
He had him.
He's very hunky in this movie. So he's the captain of this space shuttle that is off in the universe, floating around. And this movie in particular was groundbreaking for lots of reasons. It was one of the first movies that talked about humans going faster than light. So they open with this flying saucer, which is, you know, for the day, 1950s, pretty, like, as realistic as you're going to get.
Yeah.
A flying saucer, and they come upon this planet called Altair. And it's an all-man crew, and they, you know, they're warned, don't land on this planet or I am not responsible for your, you know, demise. But they insist because it's part of their grand mission is to go and explore the universe and meet people and help them if they need it. And so looks beautiful. The film is beautiful. They land. They meet the two people that are on the planet, which is an older gentleman who is a doctor, professor, and his daughter. They find out, they want to know what happened to the other settlers that had settled the planet, come to find out that they all fell ill when they arrived, and that, you know, some mysterious thing got them. And as you go along, you know, the space shuttle has lots of earmarks of, like, Star Trek, got the Star Trek vibe from that. Mm. And I found out that Forbidden Planet was a big inspiration to Gene Roddenberry when he was writing and starting to
develop. Oh, you can see that.
Definitely.
Yeah, and, you know, they shot this Forbidden Planet on the MGM lot when they took up the whole lot, which apparently didn't happen often. And it was just quite an undertaking for them to do this movie. It wasn't, you know, a cheaply made movie. Mm. So anyways, the characters land. The starship is very much like what I would call, like, in that time period of movie, a Navy ship. Like, the guys kind of act like Navy guys. You know, there's a cook. Oh, there's always the, comic relief from the cook.
Wacky alcoholic cook. Which, very
50s. So yes. 50s. And it was that was really one of the few things that bothered me about the movie. The other thing that bothered me was the interactions with the daughter, who is played by Anne Francis. So she plays, you know, the only female on this planet, but also the only female that these men in the spaceship have seen in over a year because they've been traveling the universe. And she gets treated very poorly at first because, though she's never seen other men other than her father, they are very, you know, captivated by her, and she doesn't understand why, you know, they are accusing her of being flirtatious and teasing them with her scantily clad outfits, which was so, like, the worst part of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, but at the same time, I get it. Like, I mean, at the time period, I get that. They needed some conflict between the male character and the female to fall in love. And it was, you know, Leslie Nielsen's character telling Anne Francis's character.
That's the 50s sci-fi convention. Right. You needed to have a beautiful woman.
Right.
Often she was a scientist.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And sadly, in this one, she's not.
She's not.
But she's the daughter. And, like, at one point, you know, she's in this pond and she's like, why don't you come swimming? And Leslie Nielsen says, well, I don't have a bathing suit. And she's like, what's a bathing suit? Why would you need that? And it's just very, you know, and he's like, you know, trying to be a gentleman and turning away. And, like, that's when the next scene happens and he's saying, you know, you can't be walking around scantily clad around my men, you know, like that kind of tension thing. But other than that, the other context of these, of there's this monster killing people slowly, a couple of the crewmen die, and so it's trying to find that out, what's this monster. This movie was also groundbreaking for the electronic music that they used in it. The score had gotten awards, and it was groundbreaking because it was the first electronic musical score, and it was done by a couple, BB and Louis Barron, and they were found, the story goes, one of the producers found them in a beatnik, quote unquote, beatnik bar, making this music, and they made their own electronic music, bending circuits and stuff, before, you know, I guess in the 60s when they invented machines that would make that electronic music for
it's
you.
It's really eerie sounding, like it's a really great score.
And actually, it wasn't until years later, decades later, that they issued a full, like, record of the score. So all of this happens, you know, you get that Star Trek feel because they have to report to a council and that kind of thing. So I think the difference about Forbidden Planet as opposed to the other movies that we'll talk about is that it's very smartly done. They talk about psychology, they talk about physiology, about a history of a culture, like this planet has a cultural history and who they were. And they try to get, like, you know, intelligent about it. It's not just, let's be afraid of the other. So I think that's probably why it's one of the better, not just because it's pretty, but I think it's also because they fleshed out, you know, the storyline, and it's not just who's the big bad thing.
When it parallels Shakespeare's A Tempest.
Right.
Definitely. Yes.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it. I will watch it again. I probably should have just bought it because it's just so pretty. And the story, like, even though that definitely has the sexist 50s vibe going on, I can appreciate it enough to, like, maybe scan past the art.
And the set design, I just have to say, I've always described it as mid-century modern gone berserk. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's amazing. I would want to live in that house in Forbidden Planet, even though you're constantly being attacked by this monster. And it's fine because it's amazing looking. It's tubes. It's starburst clocks. Yeah. It's Lucite furniture.
Yeah.
It's great.
The bright, bold colors. The special effects that were animation were done by a Disney animator, which is why they look so good. I mean, it has, as like the precursor to when, you know, in Star Trek, you see someone transport, transport.
Yes. Yes.
You see this in this movie. It's probably one of the first times you ever see, you know, that idea of humans transporting to different places. And I was just in awe about it. I had to play it one more time. So it's just a great, especially for a sci-fi person, it's a great movie to watch to see where some of the things that I enjoy now came from.
Yeah.
And I would be remiss to not mention Robbie the Robot, which was one of the most...
star of the movie.
Yeah, star of the movie. And one of the most... the first robot to be in a film that had a personality, basically, is what they call it. Mm-hmm. He went on to have his own little TV show and, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, this movie in a lot of ways was groundbreaking. And
it's iconic. I mean, Robbie the Robot's just so iconic.
He is the 50s.
Yeah, he is the 50s. Yeah.
He's the symbol of 50s
sci-fi. Well, the idea of that he can recreate anything. He just analyzes the molecules and he can recreate whatever you want. It's very 50s idea of what the future is going to be.
He can create booze for the funny alcoholic cook.
Right. And he can make more scantily clad outfits for the young lady.
More miniskirts.
You know, it's very interesting. But I loved it. I highly recommend, you know, watching it if you like sci-fi. And
And also, I think in terms of the 50s kind of political cultural context, I think it was also about the space race and about us getting to space first, because it's all about exploring and trying to basically colonize this planet.
Right.
It seems like that's what they're going after. And it's very pro-government because the government is being very benevolent. We're going to go help these people on this planet.
Right. And the father is very much like, stay away, because not just stay away because I think you're going to be endangered, but stay away because this is my
business.
This
is my space.
Yeah. You can't colonize what's already colonized.
Right.
Which is an interesting concept that is not much in.
And let's not even get into the Oedipal stuff with the father and the daughter who have been living alone on this planet. Her and her scanty miniskirts. And
he touches her a lot.
Yeah.
Touches her a lot. There's some jealousy between him and Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah.
And to not give away the entire plot, it goes into there when it, you know, who the monster is, how the monster manifests. That
right.
Kind of thing.
That's right.
It has to deal with him reacting to his daughter. Falling in love with Leslie Nielsen's character. Right. And it's so, there's definitely set layers there.
And that's The Tempest. That all happens in The Tempest as well, the Shakespeare play. Yeah. So definitely one of the most beautiful. And as I mentioned, probably one of the first big budget studio sci-fi films.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to maybe take it to the other end of the spectrum. Probably one of the least beautiful, cheapest science fiction films of the 1950s, or really any decade ever. But also one of my favorites is the infamous and amazing and endlessly rewatchable for me, Plan 9 from Outer Space by Ed Wood, the great Ed Wood. Filmed in 1956, but not actually released until 1959. This to me sort of epitomizes the kind of magic of low budget filmmaking. It's a can-do attitude. We've got to get this film done. So Ed Wood, of course, has the reputation of being the worst director of all time, which I think is not really warranted. And this is his supposed crowning achievement of crap, they say, like the worst film ever made. Many people have said that.
No one in this room.
No one in this room. But I think it's much too entertaining to be considered the worst film of all time. I've seen a lot of bad movies that put me to sleep and they're dull. And this is not dull.
I've seen, just in getting ready for this podcast, I've seen more boring 50s sci-fi films. The Atomic Submarine is not a very fun film to watch.
Snooze fest.
I did not like it.
No. This is full of some sort of weird, demented passion that you just, you really kind of glom onto. It's very charming in a way.
Yeah.
That's a good word, charming for
it. It's very charming. So again, for those of our listeners who are not familiar, there's really no need to go into depth on the plot of Plan 9 from Outer Space. Essentially, there were apparently plans 1 through 8, which didn't work out, I guess. We don't really know what those plans were. Aliens in flying saucers are coming to the planet Earth with Plan 9, in effect, to do some sort of takeover of the Earth, which involves reanimating dead corpses to use as an army to do something. We don't know.
I don't even know why. Yeah.
No. And vampire is involved.
Vampire is involved. Bela Lugosi is involved. There's there's a little bit of a message in the film, if anything, which was also used by The Day the Earth Stood Still and a number of 50 sci-fi films, which is that Earthlings had to be saved from ourselves because we're so destructive. And although in the typical kind of Ed Wood fashion, he described, one of the aliens continually describes us as stupid, stupid, stupid people, because it's great dialogue. Like, we're stupid, we need help. Mm-hmm. So they're going to do that by creating zombies who will destroy us or something. but really what's amazing about the film is just the kind of sheer pluck. Like, Ed Wood did not have money. He did not have talent necessarily, but he had passion. He got out and did it. He made a lot of films, Glen or Glenda, Bride of the Monster, Night of the Ghouls, Orgy of the Dead, one of my favorites. And he didn't care. He didn't care that he didn't have the resources that the big guys had. So you get pie plate flying saucers on visible strings. You get graveyards filled with styrofoam headstones. You get people tripping over things. You get shower curtain doors in military plane cockpits.
Somebody filling in for Bela Lugosi because he died that looks nothing like Bela Lugosi.
Classic.
Yeah.
You know, he was friends with Ed Wood, Bela Lugosi, had some footage of him. Let's put this in the film, but he died. So we'll just use that footage, match it with
this dentist.
Yeah, Ed Wood's, or chiropractor.
Chiropractor, that's right, not a dentist.
Who was like a foot taller with blonde hair instead of black hair. Keeps the cape over his face, so you don't know. I mean, you know, obviously. And this great stable of actors, Tor Johnson, the Swedish wrestler, and Vampira, the horror movie hostess. My favorite Ed Wood actor is Criswell, who was a TV psychic in the 1950s. So he usually introduced the Ed Wood films, warning us of the impending doom. As he says, in the future, these future events will affect you in the future. And it's true.
That's what happens. You can't argue with logic like that.
So Plan 9, I think, is really just amazing. It's fun to watch, but it also addresses a lot of the concerns of the 1950s sci-fi films. One of the interesting ones being UFO conspiracy theories, which you did not get in 50s sci-fi. And you didn't really start getting that till the 60s. So I think Ed Wood was actually probably accidentally ahead of the curve. I don't know that he was always careful with ideology and ideas. He just kind of threw stuff in.
In postmodern criticism, Jeff, that doesn't matter.
I don't think so. No. No. Intention is not an issue here.
Yeah.
But a number of the characters refer to the fact that the government is covering up these verified UFO sightings.
Yeah.
He was a pioneer.
He was a pioneer. He blew the lid off the UFO conspiracy industry. So I think, and I'm not going to advocate that there's a lot more going on in the movie than you see, but I think it's more interesting maybe than people give it credit for.
Oh, absolutely.
It's fun to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was really fun. I had not seen it before. I love the movie, Ed Wood, the Tim Burton movie.
Yes.
Johnny Depp's manic performance is one of my favorite performances of all time. And I just love that movie. So I knew a lot about Ed Wood based on the movie and based on just knowing film. But watching Plan 9 from Outer Space, I was completely entertained. I did not think I would be. Again, it was one of those films where I like when I watched The Wicker Man, I was expecting both of those films, Plan 9 and Wicker Man, to be just awful and I'd want to poke out my eyes and never watch movies again.
Right.
That didn't happen even close. I was fairly entertained by both. Plan 9 from Outer Space is charming. It's got a sweetness and a goofiness that's easy to watch.
Yeah, and it's very innocent.
Innocent.
It's not a cynical attempt to attract an audience, obviously. I don't know who the intended audience was.
He's just telling a story.
He just had a story to tell in his heart, and he did it. And
it's admirable.
It is admirable. Again, I think it's easy for people to make fun and to poke fun. And it is kind of fun to poke fun, but...
Well, yeah, there are things. I mean, the Bela Lugosi issue, the bad sets,
The terrible dialogue.
The terrible dialogue.
The day for night continuity.
Oh, the day
it's
for day, night.
It's night, it's night, it's day in one scene. There's a scene where a character who's a cop has a loaded gun and he's scratching his head with the end of the gun and gesturing wildly to people with the gun to get them to go do things. And of course, you're waiting for that gun to go off and it never does. But that's the kind of magic. Like, they didn't care about realism. It's almost like a Buñuel film. It's so surreal, but inadvertent surrealism.
Yeah.
comedically.
Yes. But I think that movie really represents sort of the kind of the heart and soul of 50s sci-fi in a way.
Yeah.
Because there were a lot, mostly low budget films. They weren't all like Forbidden Planet that had like major studio backing.
No, they were like the giant Gila monster and Wasp Woman and
The Brain That Wouldn't Die.
The Brain That Wouldn't Die. That's
another
a great
favorite
one.
Of mine too.
Yeah.
So I think it's definitely worth sort of integrating into the canon of 50s sci-fi.
Yeah. I think it definitely is. And I, gosh, again, I find it so much more entertaining than a lot of the films I did watch in prep for this. Some other 50 sci-fi, like The Atomic Submarine is the one that stands out to me as the most boring by far.
Boring.
Yeah.
But I think a great bad one that's also very entertaining is The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, mm-hmm. which yeah. I think really... It's probably not as bad. It's not nearly as inept as Plan 9 from Outer Space, but it's pretty bad. But it does sort of tap into the kind of gender fears of the 50s
in
an interesting way, that the most horrifying thing is a 50-foot woman.
Who has been scorned. Her husband cheated on her.
And needs revenge.
Yes.
Well, and this is after World War II, right? Women had gone to work, and now we're wanting to put women back in their place. And so women working is women being bigger.
Bigger, stronger.
Right, and so that is a real concern, that women are not going to go back from the workplace back to being Betty Crocker at home.
Right, she's literally busting out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the things I love about the movie is that she's also got full makeup and hair as a 50-foot woman.
Imagine her makeup.
Where she got the Maybelline, I don't know. And a 10-gallon drum, I guess. Yeah. But that, I think that's an interesting thing, that those movies were actually a little more radical than we think, because they were able to just address these kind of serious issues under the radar, because they were made for the drive-ins.
Well, yeah. You know? Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And the director said he didn't necessarily intend it, but I mean, it's really talking about McCarthyism underneath.
Oh, yes. Clearly.
And clearly, yes. Right? It's these people who you've got to think a certain way. And that's just it, right? And that's what McCarthyism was trying to do, was trying to force people to deny communism. And that's exactly what's going on in Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And there's real subtext to it.
Yeah, and the idea that your neighbor may not really be your neighbor. I mean,
yeah.
That was the paranoia of communism.
Exactly.
You never knew who was a commie.
Yeah. And so you didn't know who was replaced and who were the bad guys in Invasion. A very watchable film, too. Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Great,
I watched for the first time prepping for this.
Really,
and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Creeps still.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's creepy. It's really good. Really well made.
Yeah. And speaking of well-made films that were also, I think, overt political statements, I think we wanted to touch on Godzilla, the original Godzilla.
Yeah.
Gojira
from 1954.
Yes.
It was made in Japan. And it's probably the most overtly political of the bunch. It was so political, in fact, that when shown in the U.S. years later, they cut 40 minutes and reshot 40 extra minutes with somebody, an American, explaining things.
Raymond Burr just got stuck in there.
Right.
And explained everything.
Gets thrown in.
Yeah.
Yes. Explaining, rather than allowing talk about atomic bombs and about destruction of Japanese cities, they couldn't do that for the American version. It had to be whitewashed.
Right.
And so this really is, I mean, it Godzilla from 1954, I probably don't need to tell you the plot, but I'll do it very briefly. There's a fishing boat that's out. I think it's a fishing boat, isn't it? The first one that disappears.
Yeah.
And it disappears, and they don't know what happens. And so another boat is sent out to rescue or find out what happened, and it meets the same fate, with only a couple survivors washing up on the beach. And they speak incoherently, but obviously there's something huge out there. And so the citizens of Japan are scared and worried. More fishing boats or more boats start disappearing, and then eventually Godzilla makes his way to the island and starts crushing towns and creating a conundrum for people. How do you deal? He's an ancient monster that was reawakened by the atomic testing,
right?
The nuclear testing that was going on. And so here, man's folly has brought on this monster, which is destroying Japan and acts as a nuclear weapon. I mean, he stands in for a nuclear bomb. He's destroying towns.
Yep.
And in fact, there was a fishing boat, a Japanese fishing boat with 23 men on it in real life after World War II, like 1952, 1951, that they came upon American testing of a nuclear bomb, and the men all suffered radiation poisoning, and that stands in for, or the first boat that disappears stands in for what happens to those men, those 23 men on the fishing boat. And so it really is very political film. It's really looking at the destruction. And this is something that if you were watching in Japan in 1954, 1955, you were probably 20 or 30 years old. You had seen that kind of destruction. Firebombing of cities and the nuclear annihilation of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. So I mean, this is stuff that really hit these people hard seeing it. Mm-hmm. And as has been pointed out by Heather, pointed out that his Godzilla's skin represents the people who were suffering from radiation poisoning. Right. And Godzilla's a rubber suited man in a rubber suit.
Yeah.
That's really great, though. It's a really great film.
It's a wonderful movie. Yeah. And seeing it with an audience, they re-released it a couple years ago in a new restored version. And we showed it at the Loft Cinema. And I think a lot of people came thinking it was going to be the campy later Godzilla films, where he was the professional wrestler. Fighting Mothra and Rodan and Ghidorah and all the other kaiju monsters. And people were very taken aback by how serious the original Godzilla is. And there's a sequence in the film where you're looking at these people who have been blasted by his radioactive breath. And they're actually in a fallout shelter.
Yeah.
With radiation scarring on their face. Mm-hmm. And people were literally gasping in the theater because it's not maybe what you would expect if you don't know what you're getting into.
It's not the cheesy, campy Godzilla at all.
It's not the 70s. That's the first version of Godzilla that I've ever seen was the 70s ones.
Yeah.
So I think people were just assuming that was happening, not this original one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was fighting the smog monster and Megalon, which I love those movies.
Those are fun,
those
too.
Those are great.
They're great, yeah.
Not as deep, though.
Not as deep.
But this is a deep film. This is a serious film. And I watched it. I stayed up late on a Friday night with my son, who's 8, and we watched Godzilla, and he absolutely loved it. You can get the Blu-ray on Criterion now, which is all cleaned up and super great, and has the original, you know, it's in Japanese with the English subtitles, and so you really get the full effect of what the original film was supposed to be, not the film that people saw in the 60s in America.
And it was a very respected filmmaker, Ishiro Honda, who did a lot of those kaiju monster movies, but they all had... He did Attack of the Mushroom People. later.
I have to check that out.
Which sounds completely goofy, but it's really kind of a serious, interesting film.
Oh, wow.
And he did a lot of films like that. And so I think he was sort of the go-to guy in Japan at that time for making maybe the more thought-provoking monster movies. And Toho Studios, I mean, they're the ones that know how to do it.
Yeah.
So I think we should also maybe just talk about the new Godzilla, Shin Godzilla. Which just came out. It's the first Godzilla film from Toho Studios, I think, in 12 years.
Oh, wow.
And we've had an American reboot since then, a couple years ago. But this is Shin Godzilla, which kind of translates as new Godzilla. So it comes from the idea that this is the first time anyone has ever seen Godzilla. But it's set in modern day. And this is clearly, it's dead serious. It's much like the first one. It's not professional wrestling Godzilla at all. And it's clearly a comment on the Fukushima nuclear disaster and the tidal wave that happened a few years ago in Japan. This Godzilla is just sort of a throwback to the original Godzilla, and that he's just a product of our folly. Radioactive waste sort of brings him to life. Stomps through Tokyo. The film is all about bureaucracy and the government trying to figure out how to stop Godzilla at the expense of the citizens who are being crushed and blasted while they're basically spinning their wheels in the government, trying to figure out how to get a mandate to do this and how to get an edict to do that. And so it's obviously sort of a comment on Japanese government and how slowly they responded to the nuclear meltdown crisis. But it's also got Stompin' Godzilla. You know,
which is always good.
Which is great. And they made sure that he looked not like a smooth CGI monster. He looks a lot like a man in a rubber suit. Hmm. But he is CGI, so he's a little fancier.
A little fancy.
Yeah, but I think Toho Studios understands that that's the Godzilla of nightmares. It's not. Right. It's something that doesn't look real. And I think that's where American the American remakes have sort of fallen down is that they try to make Godzilla look like a real thing.
Yeah.
And he's not. He's a giant lizard.
Right.
Like, he should look a little unnatural.
Well, that's what we were talking about earlier about people, they don't grasp that science fiction is science fiction. It's things that don't exist, so they're not supposed to look like. They right. might have a hint of right. what you see in the real world, but like Godzilla, you don't need him to be the cleanest CGI lizard you've ever seen.
No.
You want him to be scary. So I think, I don't know, I think sci-fi gets discounted for that a lot, that there's layers and depth to it and that you don't need to polish it so much and focus on the action, but more of the storyline and the characters.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, at its best, it's an idea-driven genre.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With action around it.
Well, that's right. In my favorite sci-fi, probably this stands for any movie, but I love subtext in a film, and sci-fi can give you that. Great sci-fi, like The Matrix, is filled with great subtext. Mm-hmm. You know, it's talking about something that we all identify, and that's what these 50 sci-fi films were doing, was it was all about the subtext, and, you know, it's all about McCarthyism, it's all about falling in line, or it's all about the nuclear bombs that we dropped. And I think that that's what makes sci-fi great when it's great is great subtext.
Right. And I think in the 50s, as we also discussed earlier, they didn't have the constant news cycle that we have today. So I think people sort of worked out a lot of messages through filmmaking in a way that they don't today, because we have access to all of this information, whereas I think citizens did not necessarily have that in the 1950s. So I think there was a lot more sort of a need for art, in a way.
For art to express what's going on
exactly.
in
even
culture.
Even if it's really hidden in the subtext of a 50-foot woman, it's still saying something that was resonating with people then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And addressing real fears and concerns. Because you weren't getting all that news back then.
No.
You know?
No,
well,
it's
now
true.
Everyone's so focused on technology and making everything look so good. With CGI and bigger and better digital HD cameras, that I think a lot of that subtext gets thrown aside and forgotten when they're focusing on that other technical stuff. And I think that if sci-fi went a little bit back to that, it would be better.
Well, I think that pendulum will swing that way. I mean, we see that in art throughout the ages, where there's a push for realism, and then painters recognize we don't want to be like what our fathers were painting. We want to paint something different.
Right.
We want to make something different. And so I think that that's what will happen with sci-fi films too, and the tendency to go for ultra realism. I think that that will wane ultimately.
Yeah. And I think the tone changes over the decades. The 50s sci-fi was all based on fear, I think, and fear of the unknown. In the 60s, we had the Star Trek generation, which was about optimism. Maybe about the peace, love, and understanding culture, and we were going to make a better world off Earth somewhere else in the future.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then in the 70s, it was total apocalyptic, like dystopian science fiction. So it changes decade to decade. And so it'll be interesting to see where we go forward. Now we're very much in an action-oriented entertainment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Distraction mode with science fiction that it's not really addressing.
I mean, it's superheroes now.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at
subtext,
now.
Subtext, but it's not. I mean, the Avengers have subtext, but it's not as deep as it used to be.
Right. Yeah. Which is why the new Godzilla is interesting, because it is coming from Japan and it's very politically motivated. And so I think that's where you're getting that really thought-provoking science fiction
that's really cool.
Outside the United States.
Let me ask you this about Shin Godzilla. In the original Godzilla, there's a group, as the movie goes on and as Godzilla continues to terrorize people, there are still people in the film who are like, but there's only one Godzilla. We can't kill it. Because is there any of that in Shin Godzilla? Do people in Japan say, well, we can't kill this thing?
No, that's interesting. Everyone wants it dead. They just can't figure out how to do it.
Ah, I see.
Interesting.
So who steps in to help is the United States government. Who says we know how to do it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
We will drop an atomic bomb on Godzilla and Tokyo will just be sacrificed.
You know.
So for the greater good, because they don't want Godzilla. Well, because they speculate that Godzilla will enter Los Angeles at a certain time. And so they don't want that to happen. So we're going to destroy him and sacrifice Tokyo. And needless to say, a lot of the residents of Tokyo are not thrilled with that because, oh, this has happened before.
Right. We didn't like that before.
Then it wasn't great then.
That's what brought Godzilla in the first place.
Right.
Of course, Shin Godzilla doesn't reference that Godzilla, though.
No.
It's standalone.
Brand new story. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, but it is interesting. There's no voice of scientific reason saying we need to study this monster, and because it's a marvel of science and nature. It's just pure terror. It's like this thing.
That's interesting.
This thing must be destroyed, and we just don't know how to do it.
Yeah, by the end of the 1954 Godzilla, my son was pretty unhappy that they were killing Godzilla. He kept saying, but he's just doing what Godzilla does. He can't help that he's Godzilla. And this is just what a Godzilla does.
That should be a book. He's just doing what Godzilla does.
Yes, he's just fulfilling his function.
Yeah.
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 To stomp and destroy.
To stomp and smash.
Well, we'll see how this plays out. It leaves it open for a sequel for sure.
Oh, good.
Of Shin Godzilla. So it was disheartening that people responded so well, because it did really, really well at the box office. So I think that's going to be a good thing.
Are you guys showing it anymore?
No, it was a limited run. You could only show it for, it was about a 10-day period.
Oh, wow. That's unfortunate.
Yeah, because we could have kept running that forever. People, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. My friends all who saw it loved it.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it myself.
Well, and just small spoiler, Godzilla now shoots lasers out of his back.
Oh.
Or its back. It's genderless.
It's genderless.
So it's also a nod to sort of contemporary gender roles in terms of gender selection and identity. And
interesting.
Check it out. I say check it out. Shin Godzilla.
Well, and check out 1950 sci-fi.
Check out 50 sci-fi.
We had so much fun. Did you guys? I mean, I had so much fun going back and watching some of these. Some of them were snoozers and I just had them playing in the background.
Yep.
But there were some really good things. And there's some Roger Corman films. Wasp Woman is real fun.
Oh, Roger Corman. Yes.
And there's a lot of them that are in the public domain, actually, because no one wanted them anymore.
That's
And so I encourage you, go on YouTube or the archive.org and you can find a bunch of them.
Yeah, lots of them on YouTube. Yeah. That's how I watched a few of them.
Yeah. It's a little sad. It's sort of it is a genre that's fallen into disrepute, I think, because they were made for drive-in audiences and they weren't seen as worthy of keeping as cultural documents. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them disappeared, public domain. Yeah. So, yeah, check them out. I mean, I think you'll be surprised at how great a lot of them are.
Yeah, Godzilla in particular blew me away at how good it was as a film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Forbidden Planet, legit great film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Planet 9 from Outer Space, not a legit great film, but... A film that you should watch because it's really fun and important in the genre, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and sweet. It's got an innocence about it, like we talked about, that I think is worth watching.
It'll encourage you to go out and make a movie.
Yeah.
Because you're going to say, I can do better than that.
Yes.
So I'm going to do it. So
it's
you should
perfect.
Do it. You should do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Go out and make your own sci-fi movie. Okay. Well, thank you, Heather and Rusty. That was great.
Sure.
Thanks, Jeff.
Next time on the Mini Rules of Film Club, we're going to look at rule number 482, which is the 50s were nifty, but 1999 was mighty fine, which means we're going to be looking at one of the benchmark years of American cinema, I think, is 1999.
Indeed.
Many, many, many great films released that year. And we're going to talk about some of them. So please, in the meantime, check us out on Facebook, check us out on iTunes, and check our website, theminirulesoffilmclub.com, and give us your thoughts, give us your feedback, give us your criticism, give us your praise.
Tell us something you'd like to hear about.
Just say something to us. We'll listen. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Mini Rules of Film Club.